This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Yesterday evening, Roger Goodell, the commissioner of the National Football League, suspended Atlanta Falcons quarterback Michael Vick indefinitely. In a letter to Vick, the commissioner cited conduct that was, quote, not only illegal but also cruel and reprehensible in connection with the dogfighting operation in which Vick had acknowledged his connection earlier in the day. Michael Vick has signed off on a plea agreement in which he admitted that he helped run the operation and had a hand in killing at least six dogs that didn't fight well enough. Joining me now on the line to discuss the present and future of Michael Vick is George Dorman, an investigative reporter for Sports Illustrated and SportsIllustrated.com, who has been covering this story for several months. George, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me.
Given that Vick's co-defendants had already admitted to killing dogs and gambling on dog fights, and that they had said that Vick did the same, it seems like the federal government had all the leverage here. Why did the prosecutors accept the lesser plea?
I think they'd like to get it off the docket, so to speak. I mean, I think they got him on conspiracy. They got him, you know, agreeing to the higher federal statute. So I think that the idea being, let's move on, we're going to get him to admit to a felony, we're going to get him to do time, and we can go on to other cases from here.
In the plea agreement, Michael Vick claims that he funded both the dogfighting operation and the purses for the fights, but did not receive any of the winnings, and thereby technically didn't gamble. Do you think the judge will believe that?
You know, I don't think so. I think it's an interesting argument. I think, you know, I wrote on SI.com that, you know, at times legal documents can read like poetry, that they're up for your own interpretation. And I think this is a case where, you know, what do you call Mike Vick here? Do you call him half a gambler? Did he only loan his friends money to gamble? If you only lose money, can you be called a gambler if you then don't accept when you do win money? I don't think that that's something that the judge is going to make a distinction between, and I certainly don't think it's something that Roger Goodell, the NFL commissioner, is going to look at and say, oh, well, he didn't really gamble on this.
Well, that's an interesting point, because one would assume that that is what Vick and his attorneys had in mind, that by trying to kind of tread very softly around this gambling distinction, they'd be leaving the NFL a kind of loophole, then they could rehire him at some point.
Yeah, it's pretty shrewd if you read the statement of fact. You know, at one point there they say Vick did not gamble by placing side bets on any of the fights. And you read that and you say, initially you say, well, that's important there. You know, he's saying he didn't place any side bets. But, you know, two sentences before he's saying he put up money that was bet on the dogs. So it's almost as if you could read it and say, well, is it okay that he bet on the dogs but didn't collect the winnings if he then didn't place any side bets? So it plants this sort of strange seed of doubt, and I think people who want to support Vick will seize on it. But at the same time, I think that the judge is a smart guy. I think if, you know, you read this and you think about it, you say, this is an attempt to back away from something that was clearly done.
Now that the plea agreement is in, what are the judge's options on Monday?
Well, the government offered 12 to 18 months. Of course, the judge can do whatever he wants. And the real issue, I think, with Judge Hudson is whether or not he will view Vick's role differently. You know, Vick's attorney is saying his role is different in that he wasn't involved in the gritty day-to-day, the gambling in that way, or the killing as much as the others were. But the judge could also say, if it wasn't for Mike Vick's money, then this dogfighting operation would have never occurred. So I think he has this option of either treating Mike Vick like one of the guys, like one of his other dogfighters, mm-hmm. or he has this option of saying, you know, if you hadn't funded this, if it wouldn't have existed, and therefore you are the ringleader, so to speak, and so I'm going to penalize you even harder.
Plenty of athletes have been able to rehabilitate their images and their careers after brushes with the law. What will Michael Vick have to do to reclaim his good name, or is that even possible in this case?
It begins with him having to show real remorse, and I also think it begins with things like we didn't see yesterday in that statement of fact. You know, I believe that sporting fans can accept giving someone a second chance if we felt like there has been actual sincere apologies and an admittance of what they did. And this reads to me like Mike Vick's trying to admit half of what he did. And I think that's a bit of a mistake. And they're going to want him to do some time away from the game. But I think they want to see him be penalized, show some sincere, you know, remorse over what he did, and then also vow to put an end to the practice.
In covering this case, you have had to familiarize yourself with the world of dogfighting. How popular does it seem to be with NFL players?
You know, people ask me that quite a bit, and I say, look, there are NFL and NBA players who fight dogs. But I don't think, and I haven't certainly found evidence of, dogfighting operations run by athletes or involving athletes on the scale of this one. And I don't know that we'll ever see that again now, especially given the cautionary tale that Mike Vick has become.
That last point that you made was going to be my next question. I would think that any athlete would have to think twice, if not three or four times, before getting seriously involved in this activity again, given how this is all playing out.
Yeah, I think that a lot of guys just simply weren't aware how serious a crime this was. And I think now they know that this isn't something that you'll get a slap on the wrist. They also know that fans have reacted to this, and they now know that, you know, in a way, fans would prefer you drink and drive than you fight dogs, as scary as that sounds. It seems to be true. And so that's maybe the great victory for animal rights groups here, is that the awareness level has been raised to a point that sort of cool people, athletes, musicians, you know, who were involved in this might step away from it, and in turn that might have a trickle-down effect that prevents, you know, next generations from participating.
George Dorman is an investigative reporter for Sports Illustrated and SportsIllustrated.com. George, thanks again for joining me.
My pleasure.
The National League Central Division is now home to a three-team race. The St. Louis Cardinals, despite playing most of the season with a sub-500 record, have surged the last 2 weeks. Their turnaround began with the arrival of help from an unlikely, though not totally unfamiliar, source. Only a Game's Greg Eklund reports.
Very little waiting out of gate 4, gate 5 on Clark. Very little waiting out of gate 4, gate 5.
As another weeknight sellout of more than 42,000 fans filed into Busch Stadium for a St. Louis Cardinals home game, a large dusty crater sits across the street side of the old Busch Stadium, since demolished by a wrecking ball. That ballpark was once the scene of Rick Ankiel's worst nightmare. 7 years ago, the 21-year-old rookie pitcher threw a major league record 5 wild pitches in the third inning of the division series opener against Atlanta. His promising career as a power pitcher started to unravel even after he had won 11 games with 194 strikeouts in 175 innings. Now, Ankiel admits there's an eerie feeling when he looks across the street, but he says that doesn't matter now.
It's kind of strange, that's for sure, but I don't look into the past, and right now I speak about the present, and I'm certainly happy about what I'm doing, so...
What Ankiel has done the last 2 weeks is one of the more remarkable stories in Major League Baseball this season. After Ankiel's mound struggles continued for 4 years, he declared his pitching days over in the spring of 2005. Instead, if a path were to lead him back to the majors, it would be as an everyday player. Ankiel spent his first season as a hitter in Class A and Double A, then missed all of last year with a knee injury. This year, after signing a contract as a minor league free agent, Ankiel went to spring training with the Cardinals before he was sent down to play at Memphis, the Cardinals' AAA club. With the Memphis Redbirds, Ankiel paced the Pacific Coast League in homers with 32 and was tied for second in the league with 89 RBI. As a result, Ankiel's production got him the promotion he was looking for. So 2 years after leaving the mound as a power pitcher, Ankiel is back in the big leagues as a power hitter.
I hope in time I can turn it into being an all-around hitter and not just a power guy, so we'll see.
Ankiel out to deep right field, has a chance to leave the ballpark, it's gone! A 3-run shot for Rick Ankiel back in the major leagues. Remarkable.
On August 9th, the first day of his return to the majors, Ankiel homered against the San Diego Padres. Then, 2 days later, he hit 2 out in a game against the Los Angeles Dodgers. The transition was complete. During spring training, third-year Cardinals hitting coach Hal McRae saw the signs that Ankiel was potentially a big-league slugger. Now, McRae knows any conversation with Ankiel will not include anything about his history on the mound.
He doesn't have the pitcher's mentality, and he's a great athlete. Runs well, throws well, he's got size and strength, If you never saw him play, you never knew nothing about him, you wouldn't think this guy was a pitcher.
Rick Ankiel.
Thank you.
Hey, Rick.
In this tradition-rich baseball town, the fans haven't forgotten Ankiel's pitching history, but they are forgiving. Rod Herrenbrook of Wildwood, Missouri, a suburb of St. Louis, recently bought Ankiel jerseys for his wife Debbie and his 8-year-old son Nick. Rod Herrenbrook attended the playoff opener in 2000. He also witnessed Ankiel's first homer in his return to the big leagues.
It was pretty unbelievable. I mean, you know, the guy, it's a great story of determination and just hanging in there and doing what you believe. So, you know, it's like the natural or something like that, you know.
The Cardinals this season have trudged through a campaign marked by injuries to two of their top starting pitchers, Chris Carpenter and Mark Mulder, and their starting second baseman, Adam Kennedy. The team lost relief pitcher Josh Hancock, who was killed in an April traffic accident. And on the day Ankiel was promoted, utility player Scott Spezio was placed on the restricted list because of personal issues. Fans like Herrenbrook believe Ankiel has given the Cardinals a lift.
You know, he kind of gave us a spark. We were kind of lackluster for a while. He came up, and it seemed like it kind of inspired some people. Definitely inspired the crowd.
After Ankiel's promotion, the Cardinals put together a 5-game winning streak, their longest of the season. With a new role at age 28, Ankiel's not quite ready to say that he feels like a rookie again.
I guess somewhere in the middle. I wouldn't say I'm necessarily a veteran, but I don't feel like a rookie either. So it's been fun. I mean, when you come out here and contribute and do your part of the job and the team wins, it makes it special.
The Cardinals hope Ankiel's special story, which team notes refer to as one for Hollywood, continues through September, when St. Louis will play a total of 8 games against division rivals Chicago and Milwaukee. For Only a Game, I'm Greg Eklund in St. Louis.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. I'm Bill Littlefield, ahead on Only a Game, keeping the streak going in the Washington State slush. But first, if you called Central Casting for a racetrack guy, chances are they'd send over Harvey Peck. He's made not only a living but a life at the track, mostly by hosting TV shows and seminars in which his wisecracks about the horses, the jockeys, and the trainers are funny enough so that the bettors don't blame him when his picks don't pay off. In May the Horse Be With You, subtitled Pack at the Track, Harvey Pack and Pete Fornatale have collected some of Pack's track stories. Harvey Pack joins me now from the studios of WAMC in Albany, New York. Welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you, Bill.
Gee, Albany. I hope you're not missing races at Saratoga because you're talking to me.
Actually, I am missing a lot of races today, and I will be billing you. Or you can bill me.
I should bill you. You're probably saving money by not being there.
Every minute I'm away, I'm saving money, but I can't tell that truthfully.
Talk to me a little bit about that special quality of Saratoga. What distinguishes Saratoga from some of the other racetracks in New York and elsewhere?
Well, for one thing, it's a summer racetrack that's a vacation. You have more children wandering around, and it's so gratifying to see young people enjoying it. Also, the ratio of men to women. At most racetracks, without exaggeration, I'd say it's 3-1, maybe 4-1. Up here, it's closer to even. It's about 60-40. You see more women at the racetrack. In fact, when you're at Saratoga, you don't believe that the game isn't doing well. My grandson was with me yesterday, and we were walking out of the track. He said, Grandpa, you said it's not doing well. They're very crowded. I said, yes, this racetrack is very crowded.
Your father introduced you to thoroughbred racing, and you say of him he, quote, liked the track too much to bet a lot of money. What does that mean exactly?
He never bet beyond his means, and he had money, but he always felt that if you lost a lot of money, you wouldn't be happy going back. And he instilled that in me, and to this day, I'm a very small bettor. People don't realize how small. I actually put the dollar bet in at New York Tracks. I did. I went to them and I said, have a dollar bet. Not everybody can afford two, so they put it in.
So the distinction that you make between a gambler and a horse player is basically what? That a gambler has to go back and a horse player wants to go back?
A gambler goes just to win. A A horse player goes for what racing offers, the best day in sports. It's actually a participating sport, as you can see when after a race they stamp on their tickets. They get a lot of exercise that way. But to go there to win against the cut, even if you're the best, is very difficult.
You maintain that it's no good going to the racetrack by yourself. That way, you have written, it loses all its panache. Even if you're winning?
Well, winning is even worse. If you're winning, you have nobody to gloat. The whole object of it, it's an ego trip. After the race is over and you have some 6-to-1 shot and your friend says, how'd you come up with that? You say, what are you, an idiot? It's easy. And then... And 30 minutes later, the tables are turned and he's calling you an idiot.
Absolutely.
But it's the fun of the camaraderie. It really is.
Your book includes lots of stories about how anxious people can sometimes be to get to the racetrack. One of my favorites involves a crowd of people taking the excursion boat from New York to get to Monmouth Park in New Jersey.
Yes, that was that was with my friend Pete Axthelm, the famous writer who died about 8 or 10 years ago. We went down there, and he always said it's nice ocean breezes going to Monmouth. And one day he talked me into it, and we went down to the ship that takes you to Monmouth Park, and it predated Robert Fulton. And we got on board this thing, and then it goes to Brooklyn. We boarded in Manhattan. It circled around through the Narrows and around the harbor, picked up some more degenerate horse players in Brooklyn, and then wended its way to Atlantic Highlands, where buses would transport us to Monmouth Park. As we are approaching Atlantic Highlands, a little boat, maybe a little fishing boat, there was a woman in it and two men, and we sideswiped it gently and tilted it, and they fell in the water. And people yelled, "We just hit a boat!" And all the horse players went to that side of the ship, making it list, and they all wanted to see how the people were doing, and many of them were yelling, "Let them drown, we'll miss the double." And people said, "Throw them a life preserver, leave them there." And people were really mad. And the captain is screaming, "Stop going to that side of the ship. It'll turn over." So now we had to disperse so that we were balanced. And they eventually got these poor people and threw them a life preserver. And sad to say, we made the double.
Tell us about the horse player who commuted from New York City to Saratoga every day and was horrified when his friends suggested that he should stay the week at the house they'd rented in Saratoga Springs.
This guy, and this goes back before simulcasting, before television in the home. This goes back when we went up to Saratoga. There was no racing in New York. And this fellow lived out on Long Island, and he would get up every morning at 6 a.m., take a train into Manhattan, go to a place on, I think, 40th Street and 8th Avenue, Kasser Tours. They ran a bus, daily bus, to Saratoga, to the races and back. He would get on that bus. He'd go up there. He'd bet all the races, get back on the bus, go home, take the Long Island Railroad back to where he lived, get home about 11, 12 o'clock at night, go to sleep, get up the next morning, 6 a.m., do the same thing. So after a while, he was friendly with people at the track, and one of them said to him, "Why do you do this every day? We rent a place. You could stay with us. Come up for the meeting. Stay the 24-day meeting. Enjoy yourself." And he looked at them askance, and he said, "What? And leave my family?"
Harvey, of the business of marketing racing, you write that it was tricky because, quote, "we were marketing a narcotic." Is that perhaps unnecessarily harsh?
It's harsh, but it's basically true, because no matter how you look at it, what holds racing together is gambling. And gambling can be a disease. One of the things that I've told you, that I never bet a lot of money. I love it too much. But people get carried away. They don't keep records. They lose sight of everything, and they can lose. And to give them a T-shirt is wonderful, but it's not what we're selling. We're not selling beautiful horses. We're not selling the colors of the silks. We're selling the excitement of handicapping, picking a winner, and cashing a ticket. So in a sense, sure, it's not a narcotic like heroin, but it's sort of a drug, let's be honest. There was this fellow down at Aqueduct. I knew him. His name was Clark. When I say degenerate horse player, I say it affectionately, but he was a degenerate gambler. He just bet too much. And I would see him all the time, and I knew that he had lost it all. His wife had thrown him out. He had a lovely home. She divorced him. I think he was allowed visitation rights to his children, and that was all. He rented a furnished room near the track, and he just sat on a bench in Aqueduct. And I saw Clark one day, and I said to him, knowing all these things that happened to him, "How you doing, Clark?" And he looked up at me, and he said, "I don't know. I think I'm about even."
Though your business when you were broadcasting from the racetrack was to convince people that you knew what you were talking about, even when you won, you often told your audience that you had lost. Why was that?
Because people like you to lose. It's not that they like you to lose. We do these seminars at Ciro's now up in Saratoga, and people come and they love it. I have a handicapper. They love it. But when that handicapper tells them a horse, and they bet another horse, and they win and he loses, they are very happy. It's when I was doing the Breeders' Cup for NBC, Mike Weissman, who was the producer, said, "I'm giving you a mythical bankroll." And I said, "Let me tell you something, Mike. When you give me that mythical bankroll, every viewer wants me to lose it." And he said, "Why?" I said, "Because they want me to lose. However, in my case, don't worry about it. I will." And I did.
It was easy.
Of course. Easier to lose it than to win.
All the one-liners aside, there is an undercurrent of sadness in May the Horse Be With You, and that's because thoroughbred racing, which was so popular when you began going to the track, is in such a slump now. What are the chances that the racing game will come back?
Zero. Not come back. See, come back it already has. The overall handle is up. The tracks aren't doing that badly. Simulcasting has saved it, but it's a quick fix. It's not creating the kind of fans that we created when I was younger. My dad took me. Other people went with their older brother. And that's how they came to love the game. Now, when they're of age to do anything like that, they go to casinos, quicker fix. They go to a video poker machine. It takes 5 seconds. The racing has lost its monopoly, and with it, it's lost its drive.
Harvey Pack is the author of May the Horse Be With You, subtitled Pack at the Track, published by Daily Racing Form Press. He joined me from the studios of WAMC in Albany. Harvey, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill. I'm glad you enjoyed the book.
Skiing is probably the last thing most people think of when it's 80 degrees and sunny, but some Westerners just can't get snow off the brain, ever. Among them are some Washington State diehards who tally impressive streaks of year-round skiing without leaving the lower 48. Correspondent Tom Bonsi recently grabbed his ski poles and met the people who carve turns all year round.
I need you down there.
We're at a backcountry snowfield in Mount Rainier National Park for Slush Cup 2007. Never heard of it? Neither had I until last month. It's a highlight on the calendar of a small but growing cohort of year-round skiers. The Slush Cup takes place when a pond at the foot of Pinnacle Glacier is about half melted out. The object is to ski down the hill and skim across the surface of the pond to the opposite shore. Go too fast, and you crash up onto a rocky beach. But with too little momentum, you take a dip in ice-cold water. This is the fifth annual Slush Cup for Jeanette Morrison of Puyallup, Washington. She stays dry, so it's hard to argue with her rationale for skiing through the warm season.
Oh my gosh, the best time of the year to ski is in the spring and summer because you've got warm conditions. You don't have to worry about being cold. You don't have to pack as much stuff. It's not as hard.
There is the hike in. This one's a mile and a half. Morrison says the cruelest months for the year-round skier come in a bit.
September, October, when there's no new snow, and then we really have to hunt. But we do have our secret stashes. Someplace that we know where to go to find snow that we keep secret, and then we go there.
Morrison took up backcountry skiing in midlife. The 57-year-old homemaker appears to be making up for lost time. Morrison has gone on at least one ski trip every month for the last 12 and a half years. That has her tied for the third longest skiing streak in the West, according to the unofficial tally kept by turnsallyear.com. Charles Eldridge is the webmaster.
Everybody has their own specific criteria for what counts as skiing in a particular month. Is it accountable ski trip or not? The most widespread standard would probably be a minimum of 1,000 vertical feet of skiing.
Timberline Ski Area, high on Mount Hood, Oregon, has that and operates year-round. But Eldridge says the lifts make it too easy for some backcountry skiers. On occasion, they go to great lengths to keep a streak going.
People skiing, say, in August or September, skiing sand dunes in eastern Washington, for example. You know, if they're going to go to the effort to go out and hike up these sand dunes and ski down them, I give them credit for getting their turns in that way.
Danny Miller hasn't done anything like that. The friendly redhead did barely escape a howling blizzard on Mount Rainier once. Miller makes his living as a stage actor in suburban Seattle.
Of the few things that I would most identify with what I love to do in life, skiing's, of course, way up there. It would have to be, or I wouldn't be obsessed enough to do this.
Miller's streak is at 165 months in a row of skiing without leaving the West. That puts him in second place behind a Colorado man who's at 334 months.
At first, it was just, let's see if I can do it year-round. And then the bigger it gets, the more you feel the weight of doing it and how big a decision it would be to stop.
Miller started skiing in his 20s. It took a few years for him to get good at it. And then he says something snapped.
I wonder if it's not because it's kind of the closest to flying, I think, that you can get. You don't have any equipment. You're not in a plane or in a car or a motorcycle or anything. It's just you can almost, you know, not even notice you have two little sticks on your feet.
Miller says he gets asked a lot, how long can he keep the streak going? First, he says he has no idea. And then he says he'll keep going until it stops being fun and starts being a chore. For Only a Game, I'm Tom Bonsi at Pinnacle Glacier in Mount Rainier National Park.
Nice.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour. Everybody who listens to Only a Game emailed this week. They were all responding to producer Karen Given's story about the half marathon she ran, and each of them took up Karen's challenge to find a better name for the 13-mile race than half marathon. Frederick Ames, who hears the program on WAMC in Albany, New York, Dan Dufour, Chuck Piotrowski of Rutland, Vermont, and Lisa Zolnowski, who hears Only a Game on WBFO in Buffalo, all suggested Triska Decathon. Or Triska Decker, or something along that line. Oliver Cox also invoked a Greek root by suggesting that the race should be called the Mesothon, meso meaning middle. Thomas Reitz, who hears the program on WCBE in Columbus, Ohio, who must come from another part of Greece, claims miso means half, and he wants to call the race the miso. Dave Austin, who listens to WXXI in Rochester, New York, has combined the Roman numeral X with the number 3 to come up with 13. He informed us that he'd be running an X3 in Santa Fe next Thanksgiving. A New Hampshire Public Radio listener, Dennis Martino, wants to call the race the Parathon, figuring that makes the same sense as terms like paralegal and paraprofessional. Ron Johnson noted that the music at the end of Karen's story was halfway to paradise and suggested that the half marathon should be called the Paradise Marathon. So you got your para in there. That's pretty clever. Mary M. Muldoon, a WBUR listener, sent in several candidates, one of which is the Common Sense or Tom Paine race, since running 13 miles makes a lot more sense to her than running 26 miles does. Ms. Muldoon also suggested the Baker's Dozen race and the People's Race, quote, since it seems doable for her, maybe. Finally, Matt Rush, who hears Only a Game on WFYI in Indianapolis, wrote, Karen's story reminded me how good I felt after completing my first half marathon. Thanks for bringing back some good memories. And by the way, Karen, don't run a marathon. They are addictive, and I haven't been able to break the addiction in 14 years. You can reach us through our website, onlyagame.org, and your note doesn't have to be about half marathons. Our email address is onlyagame@wbur.bu.edu. You can leave a message on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. The construction site offering girls and boys of all ages blocks and building toys, both domestic and imported, at constructiontoys.com. And Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, Bicon.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, a demolition derby in which vengeance as a motive can't be discounted. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
On Wednesday night, the Texas Rangers slipped by the Baltimore Orioles 30-3. A couple of the Rangers had pretty good weeks that night. Were you surprised?
But seriously, folks, great to be back here.
Were you surprised that the Orioles came out for the second game of the doubleheader?
Let's be fair. They only gave up 9 in the second game.
That's a huge
improvement. They rallied significantly. There are dozens of wonderful things about this. I think my favorite thing, though, is that Wes Littleton, a relief pitcher for the Texas Rangers, got a save. He came in when his team was ahead 14-3 and held Baltimore scoreless, probably playing Parcheesi in the batter's box at that point. Wow, Texas piled up another 16 runs. If there was ever evidence that we need to sort of tinker with the save rule, I'd say it was that.
Many people might assume, Charlie, that the man with the greatest impact on baseball this summer would be Barry Bonds, but what are the chances that it will be Kirk Radomski, former Mets clubhouse attendant?
Oh, he's a good one, this one. He's going to be the one who gives up everything to the Mitchell Commission, which is going to be a lot more significant than a lot of my baseball writer pals thought it was going to be. And remember that in the great cocaine scandal of the late 1970s, it was clubhouse boys there. Well, they call clubhouse boys simply being the argot of the game, but it was clubhouse attendants there who started giving folks up.
Mm-hmm.
These are guys who know stuff.
Yesterday afternoon, Atlanta Falcons quarterback Michael Vick signed a plea agreement in which he admitted financing a dogfighting ring and having a hand in the execution of at least 6 dogs. This prompted an indefinite suspension by the National Football League. Charlie, given the reprehensible and disturbing nature of Vic's crimes, is his career over?
As long as this case has been going on, I've resisted the really dumb argument of, well, why are we all upset with Michael Vick? We let murderers and rapists and obstructors of justice like Ray Lewis back in the league, blah, blah, blah. Okay, that's not relevant to Michael Vick's crimes. Once he's out of jail, it becomes relevant. Not letting Michael Vick back into a league that has allowed Ray Lewis back into it and indeed celebrated Ray Lewis since his return is absolutely morally reprehensible.
Charlie, we've talked about concussions suffered by football players, and this season at least 9 college football teams, including the University of Minnesota, will outfit their players with helmets that have been designed to detect concussions. How many do you think each game will end up featuring?
Well, I don't know, but if the technology is moving this fast, this is a good thing. The question, of course, being is that when you bring the helmet to the coach and you say, hey, coach, the helmet says the kid's got a concussion, what does the coach do? That's the change that has to be made.
I don't generally follow Division III football teams.
You don't generally follow the NFL.
No, I don't. You're right. Not until it's time for the Super Bowl, and then it's a good TV show. But this year, I will be cheering for a particular D3 team, the Sewell Ross State University team. How about you?
Yeah, you're only liking it because there's a 59-year-old guy playing for it.
Precisely.
Mike Flint, 37 years after he left school. And 6 years before he goes on Medicare, as AP is very careful to point out. Thank you, AP,
yes, thank you.
By the way. He's going to go play some football for Sewell Ross, and God love him for it.
The U.S. national team has prevailed against not only Venezuela, but the U.S. Virgin Islands in the FIBA America's Olympic qualifying tournament. Does this mean cutting Kevin Durant was a good move?
I think keeping Michael Redd is a good move. He's made all the difference in the world. He's an outside shooter, which is exactly what they need. He hit a whole bunch of them. And remember, the U.S. Virgin Islands didn't have their most famous player who's plays for the San Antonio Spurs. His name is Tim Duncan. He wasn't there. They were doing this against an undermanned U.S. Virgin Islands squad.
Yeah, I was going to say it was roughly the basketball equivalent of 30-3, I guess. Meanwhile, on behalf of the NBA, former federal prosecutor Lawrence B. Pedowitz will be studying the league's anti-gambling efforts and the procedures by which the league hires its officials. So, an internal investigation. By golly, that'll get to the bottom of things.
Well, I mean, you've had the external investigation, which resulted in Donaghy's taking a plea and facing the law. I don't think that the feds are in any way interested in whether or not referees go to casinos and gamble legally, but the NBA may be.
Just when you thought that Las Vegas might forget about attracting a pro team, Harrah's Entertainment is betting that Sin City can land a franchise, or is betting the right word? I'm not sure here.
Boy, what great timing, huh? Harrah's wants to partner with the company, I would point out, who's behind the enormously successful move of bringing David Beckham to not play for the LA Galaxy.
Well, he's been playing a little bit.
He's been wandering the sidelines. Why don't they should sell the guy a ticket? Anyway, they're going to build a 20,000-seat arena in Vegas capable of housing an NBA or an NHL team. I would say at this point they have no chance of housing an NBA team. The NHL, however, is desperate enough to put a team there.
You know it's hard times when the bank comes after your yacht, Charlie, and that has apparently happened.
If I had a nickel for every time it happened to me, I could buy my yacht back.
Well, it has apparently happened to at least one former but not officially retired NBA player this week.
Latrell Sprewell had his yacht seized in Manitowoc, Wisconsin, a lovely town that I'm quite familiar with.
Yachting capital of the world.
And by the way, the yacht was called Milwaukee's Best. I think he deserves to lose the yacht simply for naming it after one of the worst beers ever brewed and housing it in Wisconsin.
On the eve of the WNBA playoffs, the league is apparently faced with a potentially serious problem, namely losing some of its stars to teams in other countries. What? The namby-pamby women are getting tired of playing 11 months out of the year so they can make a living?
Yeah, well, I mean, the money for women's basketball is much better overseas. And there's certainly no moral, ethical reason for them to stay here where their league is largely ignored and put on TV and considered to be a redheaded stepchild to the actual NBA. They're going to go overseas and make a lot of dough, and good luck to them.
Athletes competing in the duathlon on the shores of Loch Ness may worry about various dangers that could pop up during the race, but the event's organizers say that they are, quote, planning for all eventualities, including...
Yes, Master, we're buying monster insurance. Yes, you can insure yourself against Nessie nibbling on your toes while you're in the duathlon. I would pay any member of this duathlon any amount of money to claim that he has been nudged by the Loch Ness. Prove he hasn't!
I would have won. And finally, Charlie, pro soccer players, unlike players in the National Football League, can get away with goofy celebrations after goals, but apparently impersonating a superhero crosses the line, even for soccer.
No Spider-Man masks in Bolivia. If you win, who knows why people wear masks in Bolivia? There are all kinds of reasons
we don't need to get into.
But this guy apparently ran around with a Spider-Man mask tucked in his pants against the advent, as the Wizard of Oz would say, of his scoring a goal, did it, ran around, got fined. I think that all of a sudden, this looks pretty innocent scandal-wise to those of us in the United States.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine, and he joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thank you, Bill.
I'm just a humble radio host born in the days when enraptured families sat together before the softly glowing Philco set. Your modern world of streaming media and MP3s frightens and confuses me, but that doesn't mean you have to feel the same way. To access podcasts of Only a Game, please go to onlyagame.org. Demolition derbies have been around for as long as many racetracks and some county fairs have. This highly interactive event, in which cars collide until only one is left moving, has been a devastating diversion. But as Ron Schachter reports from Rockford, Illinois, one racetrack has given a new twist to the standard contest of twisted metal.
Are there seatbelts in these things?
Amanda and Alan Melker look over a group of freshly painted vehicles on a grassy lot next to Rockford Speedway. On this summer Saturday night, they seem like any other married couple searching for a goodbye on a used car.
Take that one on you.
Imperial? Yeah. At least they have seatbelts. I feel a little safer.
But the cars here are very used, just imported from the local junkyard, in fact. And the Melkers are no longer married. They'll need those seatbelts in 2 hours when they square off against each other and six additional ex-couples in the second annual Divorcee Demolition Derby. Alan signed up a few weeks ago, and he can count the ways he loves this contest.
Safe way to put a dent in the side of your ex-wife's car.
legally.
Yeah.
I want that trophy. Maybe we'll get to keep the cars, too, after we're done.
Trouble is, he didn't mention his plans to Amanda until this afternoon.
He didn't tell me till a couple hours ago. I need you to do something for me. Well, what do you need? Go to the races with me tonight. Okay, and... oh, by the way, we're in a demo derby.
Amanda says that kind of communication was par for the course during their 3-year marriage. So she found a last-minute babysitter, told her young daughter that Mommy and Daddy were going to bump into each other with cars, but just for fun, and headed to the racetrack. Rockford Speedway is one of about 100 grassroots tracks around the country that serve as minor league venues of NASCAR racing. But the Speedway has also earned a reputation for more innovative events, such as its figure-eight trailer race of destruction. Earlier this season, teams of stock cars pushed around a 4-foot-wide black-and-white metal soccer ball. General Manager Greg McKern says that tonight's demo derby was an idea whose time had come.
There's all these divorced people. I mean, it's sad to say in America, but there are a lot of divorced people out there. So we decided we're going to try to divorce a demo derby. Last year we did it on a Wednesday night, which is kind of our R&D night to test out different ideas. And the crowd response was huge to it. It was our biggest Wednesday night crowd. So this year we put it on a Saturday night and brought it into the prime time, if you will.
Speedway owner David Deary adds that he's had to make some extra accommodations for this event.
The Demolition Derby is probably one of the fiercest events in motorsports. If you've ever watched a Demo Derby and you could concentrate on the drivers, you'll see the force and the G-forces that they take in these hits. So what we need to convey to these participants tonight is, you know, we're gonna stretch out prior to the event. We're gonna use our necks and get real loose the best we can. And since these people are mostly rookies, we're gonna pad their cars, some of the doors, some of the areas that their limbs will fly actually when they get hit.
Across town, Dr. Lisa Breisch has worked the past 10 years as a marriage counselor. She describes her own concerns about the divorcee derby.
Some couples may have a lot of unresolved issues from the marriage, and it could be rather tricky. And if they are very angry at each other or are not in a healthy place, things could kind of get dangerous, actually, because you're stirring up old, unresolved feelings. Or it could be actually fun and kind of a bonding experience, depending on the couple.
The drivers here seem to fit the latter category. They exchange quips and pleasantries while spray-painting decorations on their chosen cars, which have been colored blue for boys and pink for girls. The numbers on the side doors range from 1 to 5, with a 3.2 and 3.5 thrown in, representing the years the competitors stayed hitched. Amanda Melker says she's even received some ex-husbandly advice from Alan.
He said, go in reverse. That's what he told me. Just go in reverse and save your front end. That was his words of wisdom to me.
One rival, two cars down, plans on taking a more direct approach and taking no prisoners.
Oh, just floor it and go. Get them as hard as I can.
Forward or backward?
Both.
The banter stops and the faces get sober when Deary gives a literal crash course in what's down the road.
There's two parts of your body that'll get hurt in this event. Your neck and your hands. So when you're backing up or when you're going to hit somebody, get your hands off the wheel. Because if your wheel hits the car or another wall or whatever, the wheel will spin. Don't put your thumbs inside. Keep them on the outside. Never grab the wheel. Never grab the wheel.
After the lesson, the ex-couples don their helmets and start their engines.
For 3.2 years, it was Jim and Sarah Powers. She's bossy and he's lazy. Obviously, that one wasn't going to work. Then for a whole 3 years, Alvin and Amanda Melker. Well, he was a Bear fan. She was a Packer fan.
The drivers line up along the finish line with the rear ends of their cars directly across from those of their ex-spouses. Just as they shared the first dance at their weddings, they'll get the first crack at each other here. After that, it's a free-for-all. Almost 2,000 fans watch the collisions of pink and blue. After a slow start, the drivers become more aggressive, and the contest turns into a 15-minute mechanical melee. The frequent contact, dragging bumpers, and spinning wheels become metaphors for marriages gone awry as the combatants hurtle backwards and personally deliver the messages they've scrawled on their fenders. Love, hate. Call 911. Have a nice day. Some ex-wives have emblazoned large dollar signs on their hoods, reminders of alimony past due. But it soon becomes clear that this is not just a battle of the exes, but a battle of the sexes.
How many of you think the women are going to win? How many of you want to see the men burn off this year?
When the remaining two blue cars make a head-on charge into each other, the field is left to the women for the second year in a row. Amanda Bielefleet, in car number 5, is among that trio. Bielefleet races the minor league NASCAR circuit here on Wednesday nights, but she says she's found a new love.
I love totaling cars.
Have you ever had a collision before in your driving days?
Nope, never.
No?
And come out here now, I like to hit cars.
Marriage counselor Lisa Bryce suggests that the demo derby would be well served if a psychologist were present, along with the tow truck drivers and EMTs.
I think afterwards that people should do some things about how this felt. How was this experience for them before, during, and after? And how has this affected their relationship with their ex afterwards?
Bryce may soon get her wish. She's thinking of entering next year's Divorcee Demo Derby with her own ex. For Only a Game, I'm Ron Schachter in Rockford, Illinois.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Ferrati. We had help this week from Stacey Terry at WAMC in Albany. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. If you'd like to see Tom Bonsi's August skiing photo gallery or listen to stories past and present, please visit onlyagame.org. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. CDs are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. Our final word comes from May the Horse Be With You author Harvey Pack, explaining how he stayed out of trouble during his decades at the track.
Never told anybody which horse was going to win the race. That was by agreement with the Loan Sharks of America.
Yeah, very admirable, Harvey, but I wish you could have made an exception just that one time when I needed a winner in Saratoga. Just might have changed everything. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston. The Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in children, their families, and their communities. On the web at WKKF.org. Ann and John Herman, supporting City Year and the young adults who dedicate a year of their lives to community service and leadership development. CityYear.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at MacFound.org.